listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot in the news. There may or may not be something serious going on in Crimea. Apparently, a Ukrainian military base there has had a conflict and an officer has been shot. Whether this is an Archduke Ferdinand moment or whether this is just some little thing that happened, you know, history will tell. We may know in a while. But interesting, just an FYI. And the airplane is still missing, the Malaysian Airlines plane. This is getting spooky. It's getting downright spooky. Meanwhile, rolling on, global climate change. As we pass tipping point after tipping point, you know, we did a video on this, which you can see at lasthours.org, about the methane tipping point, the methane clath rates in the ocean. And Guy McPherson has been writing about this and these sorts of issues for quite some time. It seems like since 2006, anyway. And is doing a bit of a speaking tour right now. He's got a new book out. He's a professor emeritus of natural resources and ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. He's a contributor to what I find one of the most interesting blogs on climate change. It is arctic-news.blogspot.com. And his website is Guy McPherson, MCPHERSON.com. Guy, welcome to the program, or Dr. McPherson, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for joining us.
Call me Guy.
Okay. Guy, you, in several recent speeches, have suggested that we have passed so many tipping points on the road toward irreversible global climate change that it has now, that we're now in a state of irreversible global climate change that's going to bite us in the butt, presumably within the lifetime of people alive today. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I think that's right. And at Nature Bats Last, my own website, I simply collate, synthesize, integrate, and summarize the information put out by other scientists. I left active service at the University of Arizona about 5 years ago, and so I haven't had the infrastructure and especially the funding to do primary science since then. So since I left, I have been connecting the dots and putting together the information put out by other people. That information includes, at this point, 31 self-reinforcing feedback loops, 29 of which appear to be irreversible at temporal spans relevant to the human experience. And the hits keep coming. We're up to 19 as recently as last August when I presented in Amsterdam, and now we're at 31. So there's no slowing this ship down.
And these self-reinforcing feedback loops include things like what?
Like methane hydrates bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean. That was the first one reported in the refereed journal literature, reported in Science in March 2010. And that's a self-reinforcing feedback loop because as the methane bubbles out, the atmosphere gets warmer because methane is such a strong greenhouse gas. And as it gets warmer, it causes the methane to bubble out even faster. Mm-hmm. And so other examples include the melting of the Arctic ice, for example. The ice serves as a profound a source of reflectance or albedo, and you remove that ice and suddenly the energy is going into the dark ocean instead of being reflected out by the white ice. So we have warm Atlantic water, we have methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean, we have methane coming out of the Siberian region, and in fact throughout the world's boreal forests at this point is permafrost gets transformed into permamelt. We have peat in the world's boreal forest decomposing at an astonishing rate, contributing to warming, drying, therefore accelerating the decomposition of that peat, and so on.
Releasing methane and carbon dioxide.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So and those are the big two. And there are several other greenhouse gases, and if we put them all together, we're at about 480 parts per million equivalent of CO2. Right now in the atmosphere. And of course, before the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we were at about 280 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and less than 700 parts per billion methane. So the equivalent was considerably less than 300 parts per million.
What is this
CO2 equivalent?
What does this mean for our children?
We are experiencing a warmed and warming planet. It's difficult for me to imagine there will be habitat for human beings in the not too distant future. Consider, for example, that methane leaking out of the Arctic Ocean or bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean, that one feedback alone contributes so greatly to planetary warming that incorporating just that single feedback indicates that it can be as warm as 10 C warmer than baseline by 2040.
And
we've never had humans on a planet more than 3.5 C above baseline.
So you're predicting the end of humanity?
Yes.
So
and we're taking a lot of other species down with us.
Within the lifetime of our children and maybe even you and me, should we live that long?
Yes. Yes,
so,
I had every ambition of living until 2030 or 2040.
Yeah.
In fact, most people don't leave their academic university jobs until they're about 70.
Right.
I'll be 70 in 2030. I'm pretty sure there won't be habitat for humans where I live at that point.
So what do we do about this?
I frequently give relatively little advice about what we can do because it appears that so many of those self-reinforcing feedback loops are irreversible at temporal spans relevant to the human experience.
Now, didn't the IPCC just say, you know, we've got a real problem here and it may be irreversible unless we go to geoengineering?
Yes. In fact, that's exactly what they say in a report leaked from their fifth assessment, a report that, well, here's the exact quote from New Scientist at newscientist.com, hardly a sky is falling kind of organization. Here's how they open. Global warming is irreversible without massive geoengineering of the Earth's chemistry. This stark warning comes from the draft summary of the latest climate assessment by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's the lead.
Right. Okay. We just have about a minute and a half left, Guy. I'd like to get through this. So we're screwed. I know you've been suggesting that we basically take a kind of Buddhist approach to this. You talked about our being in hospice, and let's talk about quality of life and let's improve things. But you know, that said, I'm sure you're familiar with the famous bet between Paul Ehrlich and Julian Simon back in the 1970s. And how that worked out. Back in 2006, you were suggesting that by 2008, peak oil would be getting us. Could it be that human ingenuity can get us out of this the way Julian Simon predicted?
It could be, though it would surprise me because it seems to me that it's human ingenuity that got us into this mess. We keep coming up with technological means to extract wealth, financial wealth, from the planet at tremendous cost.
What do you say to those who try to discredit you by suggesting that in 2006 you were arguing that by, you know, within a few years peak oil was going to get us?
I continue to be amazed that the system has held together as long as it has, and that's right. I was incorrect in my assessment of peak oil. In fact, that only made things worse. We've known since 2009 in a paper published in Climatic Change by Tim Garrett, that only complete collapse prevents runaway climate change.
So we should have, when the warnings about peak oil came along, we should have stopped using oil. Guy, sorry, we have hard breaks on the show. The machine has started. But thanks so much. I want to get you back again to talk more about this. Hang on just a second. We're going to get stepped on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Guy McPherson, Nature Bats Last, is his blog. Guy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Great talking with you. We'll be back. And welcome back. Nate Sweet is on the line with us, producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Great. So tonight, well, great other than the fact that we're all going to die. I want to talk.
An optimistic way to start the afternoon.
Hey, yeah. Did you hear the interview with Guy?
I heard the end of it.
Yeah. Oh. So anyway, we're going to start out by talking about what happens. Really, the story in North Carolina, where Pat McCrory, the governor, for 30 years was a senior executive with Duke Energy, and then he becomes governor. And what is the first thing he does? He starts deregulating Duke Energy. And what do? They poison the state. Not a good situation.
Yeah, it's actually pretty startling. And I think a lot of people have been following North Carolina pretty closely because it's sort of a test study of what happens when crazy Tea Party Republicans take over a state and, you know, apparently becomes a disaster zone. But we're going to be having Frank Holeman. He's a senior attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center. He's from North Carolina. He's been following this issue very closely since the Dan River spill started in early February, actually on Super Bowl Sunday. He'll be with us from New York talking about the federal grand jury investigation that opened up today. We'll also be talking about, you know, what's the state of North Carolina's regulatory agencies, where do we go from here, what's the mood in North Carolina. And there's also been reports that there's another ongoing spill in North Carolina as well at another coal ash site that Duke Energy owns. So there's a bunch of stuff going on here that's pretty interesting.
There's also a pipeline spill going on in Ohio right now.
Right, right. Obviously a separate industry, but, you know, it's a pretty startling display of what kind of threat our environment is under in America right now.
It's the end of the world as we know it. Okay. Following that, we're going to have the Big Picture Politics panel. Kai Peterson and Mark Harreld will join the world-famous media superstar Nate Sweet.
Yep, I'll be on the panel once again. We'll be talking about that oil spill in Ohio you just mentioned. We'll be talking about that in the context of Keystone. We'll be talking about the GOP's quote-unquote Obamacare alternative. We'll be talking about the onslaught of outside group spending that's been going on over the past few months to try to convince the public that Obamacare is the next Stalin five-year plan. We'll also be talking about some push by liberal groups to get Sandra O'Connor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg to step down. We'll be talking about that in concert with the general politicization of the Supreme Court. And then we will be talking about, hold on one second, we'll be talking about Elizabeth Warren's push to get the government to prosecute mortgage bankster fraud, and then the Tesla motor issue up in North New Jersey. Tesla Motors essentially prevented from selling its cars straight out of the industry warehouses. The state automaker, auto retailers lobby has pushed them to sell them straight through the retailers, so it's a threat to its business model.
Yeah, this is really a libertarian argument almost, you know. It's,
yeah.
And the although I'm not sure that I can make a case for dealers being mandated by law being something that has to do with the commons or the public good. So it's not necessarily something that a liberal would support.
Yeah, it seems to me a very similar situation. I'm from Massachusetts, and for a while there's always this controversy on the ballot over whether or not we should allow wine to be sold in grocery stores. Very difficult to obtain a permit, and the main reason the permits are difficult to obtain is because it's meant to protect the liquor store industry. There's no real public benefit to only wine stores being able to sell it, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, it seems to be a similar issue. I think you're right, and they end up lobbying, and then this is an example of regulatory capture. And that's just the first half of the show. We got a bunch of other really cool stuff, and you're just going to have to wait until 7 o'clock tonight Eastern time to see it. Nate, thanks so much. I'll see you tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Does pass the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Guy McPherson is still with us. Guy, I asked Danielle to call you back because I felt like that conversation was very incomplete. And this is a really big issue. And in fact, the question that I'd like to put out to my callers, to the people watching the show right now, is if you knew that the world was going to end, basically, you know, that within 20, 25 years, or less, that most of the Earth was going to become uninhabitable for human life, what would you do tomorrow? And let me put that question to you, Guy.
I think that's a great question, Tom. First of all, thanks for having me back on after the little disruption there. What would I do? I would try to ensure the longest possible run for non-human species. I think we're done. I think that as a teacher, I would continue to try to educate people about the dire straits we're in, and I would continue to try to educate people to live as if we're in hospice, to live as if our insignificant lives matter to us and those around us, to treat each other with respect and to go out with some dignity instead of grubbing for the last dollar, instead of planning for the future that never comes. Let's live here now. Let's live in this moment and Morris, be kind to those around us.
Morris Berman wrote a couple of really interesting books, but one in particular was very, very dark, in which he was basically predicting the end of civilization, not the end of humanity, but the end of civilization. And his solution in that book, and we had him on the show talking about this, a couple of years ago, was that we should basically start monasteries. We should do what the monks did back during the Dark Ages, and write down all the collected knowledge of humanity, because it's not going to, it's all now moved onto hard drives, and those are not going to survive the crash of industrial society. Might an alternative be, if you're actually predicting the end of the human race, that, you know, biology is pretty unstoppable over time, and if anything, that's one of the big lessons of the previous five extinctions, that it's quite likely that at some point in the future, it might be hundreds of thousands of years or even millions of years, but at some point in the future, a life form as intelligent or more intelligent than us will evolve. Should we be coming up with technologies to leave behind our story and our cautionary tale?
Well, I think that's not a bad idea. I think that first we need to try to ensure that as many species as possible make it through the industrial civilization bottleneck. And that's what I'm working for. As Edward O. Wilson, a Harvard biologist, points out, it only requires about 10 million years after an extinction event, after a major extinction event, before we have a vibrant, verdant planet again. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm working for, is toward the long haul, towards the 10 million years and beyond out. Right. Will we ever see a species like ours arise again? Well, we don't know. Will we ever see Chinook salmon arise again if we cause their extinction? We don't know, but probably not. And so let's try to save the seeds, as it were, for the future, including as many species as we can possibly get through the industrial civilization bottleneck.
Now, one of the things that, you know, kind of noodling this out causes me to think that there's a higher probability that we'll survive than, for example, the salmon, is that I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that humans are the only species on Earth that has been able to create habitat under every microclimate, macroclimate that the planet has, from Eskimos to people living on the equator. And that adaptability, which comes out of our big brains, is an asset beyond just physical adaptability. Might it be that, you know, civilization will be gone and humanity as we know it will be gone, but our DNA will continue? And I mean, it looks like the last bottleneck, which was probably around 80,000 years ago, maybe 160,000 years ago, as few as 15,000-20,000 humans survived, you know, now that they're doing the DNA studies on this stuff. Could we just be seeing another bottleneck and a new iteration, a new incarnation, a new variety of Homo is going to emerge?
Could be. We don't know with great precision what the future holds, but it would surprise me. And it would surprise me because we're animals. We're human animals. We require habitat, most notably food. And if we've already seen phytoplankton in the ocean decline by 50% in the last few decades, at 0.85 C warming above baseline. When we get to 3 or 4 C above baseline, it's difficult for me to imagine we'll have a significant number of phytoplankton. That's the base of the marine food web. And so that's half our food. When we get to 3 or 4 C warming, it's difficult for me to imagine we'll have many land plants as well, especially given the rapidity with which we're approaching that 3 or 4 C rise. So without land plants, which form the basis for the terrestrial food web, and without phytoplankton in the ocean, I just don't see how we're going to feed ourselves, no matter how clever we are. I agree that we're clever. In fact, I think we chose the wrong name for ourselves. We're not Homo sapiens. Sapiens means wise. We're Homo calidus. Calidus means clever. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're really clever, and we've managed to paint ourselves into an incredible corner. And I just don't see much way out, even though we are incredibly adaptable. In fact, because we are incredibly adaptable, I don't see a way out with respect to the effectiveness with which we're destroying the living planet that we actually depend upon for our own survival.
Yeah. So you're just like dead serious about this. We're, you know, forget 2100. This is going to happen in 20 years or 30 years or less. And it's going to be not just the end of civilization, but possibly, probably the end of humanity and most other large animals.
Yeah, it's difficult for me, given what I know about the evidence so far, it's difficult for me to imagine a way out of the monkey trap into which we've stuck our hand. So, no, I don't see a way out. It's 5 years ago now that Tim Garrett published that paper. It's 7 years ago that he wrote and submitted it. It says only complete collapse from an economic perspective prevents one runaway greenhouse.
Right.
Since then, we've triggered those 31 self-reinforcing feedback loops.
Remarkable.
So I don't see a way back.
Guy, we're going to have to, again, we hit a break here, but we will continue this conversation over the weeks and months to come. Guy McPherson, Nature Bats Last is his blog, GuyMcPherson.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Thank you very much, Guy. We'll catch you. We'll catch up with you again soon. 28
Thank
minutes
you.
Past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk media for the sane among us. Okay, my take on Guy McPherson's work. I think the guy is making a really, or Dr. McPherson, is making a really important contribution to this conversation because, you know, it's a wake-up message written in blood or written in flaming letters. I mean, this is... you know, what Daniel saw on the wall, this is the, you know, the handwriting on the wall. This is that in on steroids. That said, and I agree with him that the climate situation is far more dire than our media is portraying it. It is far more dire than most mainstream scientists will concede. I can tell you that we, you know, when we were producing the video that you can see over at lasthours.org, I had some back channel conversations with a number of very prominent scientists who said, you know, I can't say this for publication. I can't say this on the air, but I'll tell you, I'm scared to death. This is really, really, really bad stuff. On the one hand, on the other hand, the official scientific consensus is that we still have 10, 15, 20 years to do something about this. The problem is, and James Hansen gave a great talk on this recently and actually published a piece, and I think it was in Science just a few months ago about this, is that had we begun to decrease global emissions back when Al Gore was running for president, the first time that the world got together and agreed that we had to reduce global emissions, back when the Supreme Court handed the presidency to oil man George W. Bush and his vice president, oil man Dick Cheney, had we begun to decrease global emissions then with the leadership of the United States, it would have taken 4 to 6% per year every year of declining emissions, which was doable. Not all that difficult to do, frankly. Put on a carbon tax, start charging the actual cost for carbon, and suddenly, and if you could get the whole world to do it, and I realize that's going to be a challenge, but it's possible. And even if you couldn't get the entire world to do it, you could do it to the world because we're so interconnected. For example, let's say India and China said, no, we're not going to do that. Then we could simply say, okay, we're going to carbon tax everything you export. So all those call centers in India that are used by all the banks in the United States, now there's a tax on every dollar that you send to the call center. We're going to tax them for the carbon that they're using for the electricity to power the call centers. And everything that comes from China, all the Chinese goods, all that stuff that you find in the Walmart, et cetera, we're going to put a tax on those when they hit our border because China's not charging a carbon tax. We're going to add a carbon tax to the imports. And so we actually could, because we're such a large part of the world economy, we're the largest consumer on the planet, we could impose a fossil fuel tax on everybody and drive the process. And then countries would say, okay, well, if we're going to have to pay it one way or another, we might as well pay it to ourselves Because the way you do a carbon tax is you collect the money from the fossil fuel industry and then you distribute all of that money back out to the people as a dividend so that when the price of gas goes up, people have more income to pay for it. But the cost of gas has gone up, which means electric cars are more economical. So people start making the transition. This is just a market-based. This is the kind of thing Republicans should love. It's a market-based reform. Had we done that when Al Gore won Florida, but we didn't learn it until a year later when the ballots were actually counted, then, you know, it would have been 4 to 6% per year. Now, if we were to do it, it has to be more like 10% per year. And if we wait another 5 years, it's going to have to be like 15% per year. Cutting emissions 15% per year, and that's just to hold us to 2 degrees Celsius, which is, everybody agrees, a disaster scenario in and of itself. But still, cutting emissions 15% per year is pretty much undoable outside of the collapse of industrial civilization, which, interestingly enough, NASA just predicted in a study that they just published, saying that, you know, civilizations rise and fall. Look at the Greeks. Look at the Romans. Expect it from us. Really? So the question, if you knew or you believed that the human race has another 10, 20, 30 years to go and that's it, and I'm not asserting that. I actually believe that we are clever enough that in the extreme habitats, in the extreme north, the extreme south, which will become much like the habitats of Michigan, that we will be able to find habitat and that we will be able to survive. I think the human race is going to survive this. I think it's going to be a very different kind of survival, and that might be a really good thing. You look at the Native American communities that were found by Europeans when they first got here. Europeans were living unsustainably, which is one of the reasons that they reached out across the planet to eat the lunch of all the natives in Africa and the United States and Asia and Europe and Australia. And they found people who were living sustainably because the natives had eaten their environment. They destroyed their environment. They killed off the big animals, the three-toed sloths and the woolly mammoths. And they killed them all off and created ecological disasters, and then they figured out, no, that's not the way to live. And maybe this is going to be the thing that causes us to figure out that's not the way to live. But in any case, knowing that, what should we do? What will you do? Guy McPherson's main suggestion, in addition to let's stop the destruction of species, which is very wise, but an extinction that takes us out is going to take pretty much everything else out. I mean, the Permian mass extinction took out 95% of all life on Earth, and it was caused by a 6-degree increase in temperature in the planet. It was produced by volcanic activity. So if that's going to happen, what do we do? What do you do? What I would do if I was certain of this is I would do as much as I could to teach everybody about the importance of living in balance with the world in the hopes that some of us could make it through and that wisdom could survive. In the hope, and I think hope dies last, in the hope that we could even stop it or at least figure out a way to make it through. And frankly, you know, I'd want to spend more time with my kids. I'd want to spend more time with my family and loved ones. And I'd like to spend more time just being present. I would meditate more. And I need to anyway. So it seems like that's all good advice. So your thoughts on this. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Well, there's good and bad news. One is the thing, as you were saying, that we have a limited amount of time when we're looking for a technological fix. Well, the good news is it's us. It's our behavior. Right now, probably over 30, perhaps over 50% of our energy is used to do absolutely nothing.
It's wasted.
Everywhere you go, there are lights on when everybody's in bed. Right now, everybody listening to you is probably wasting at least 10 to 15% of their energy in their houses right now.
With wall warts, with these little transformers that you plug into the wall.
Wall warts, lights on in bathrooms, rooms that nobody's in. We have lighting for us to see. Well, why do we have lights on in rooms that there's no human in?
Right.
But if you look at all the things all around, you go into office buildings, there are millions of bathrooms around the country with using 500 watts plus of energy where there's nobody in 90% of the day.
Right.
We could save 30% of our energy in 30 days and not have, without conservation anyway.
With motion detectors instead of switches.
Energy to do nothing.
Yeah, I agree.
Then,
Go ahead.
So it's our behavior. And then there are other things, like why don't we, one thing that we could do very quickly would just improve lifestyle. Switch to a four-day work week where we stagger the weeks. You work Tuesday through Friday 1 week, Monday through Thursday the next. Suddenly you've got 26 four-day vacations a year. You save 20% of the commuting energy. That's massive.
Right.
And you save the money and the time getting ready for work, and you'll probably be much happier at work working 4 9-hour days. You'd be more productive.
And these are all things that make perfect sense if we were actually paying the cost of carbon. If we put a carbon tax in that was $25 a ton and that went up $10 per ton per year, and this is what James Hansen is proposing, and then 100% of that money gets redistributed back to the population. So we can deal with the increased costs, and we can also have some extra money in our pocket to do things like replacing the light switches in our bathrooms with motion detectors. If we did that, then the cost of commuting starts going up substantially, and so your solution makes sense. The cost of electricity goes up substantially, so your solutions make sense. I mean, these are things that drive themselves. They become positive reinforcement loops.
As Pogo said, I've seen the enemy, it's us.
Yes.
And yes, these positive reinforcements do work, but for the people listening, you're intelligent enough to listen to Tom. You could go right now, go around your room and turn off lots of things.
Yeah.
Anything that's plugged in that's not being used should be unplugged.
Yeah.
And there are great power surge protectors now that have outlets where, like, say, for example, you've got your TV plugged in with all your other things, like cable boxes tend to use 40 watts of energy 24 hours a day.
Right. In the UK, they have on-off switches next to every electrical outlet or most of the electrical outlets. So you literally can turn off the entire outlet.
Yeah. Well, the smart surge protectors now, like say you've got four things that are supplemental to your TV. These plugs are turned off automatically if your TV's turned off.
Oh, that's interesting.
$15.
So yeah, the smart surge detector detects that you've turned off the main use of power and then it just shuts down everything else?
Yes. I got a great one right here. I'm grabbing the box. It only cost me $15. This company would be happy that I'm saying this right now. Zuni Digital has one.
Zuni Digital.
So,
Z-U-N-I.
It's only cost me $15, including shipping.
Amazing. Okay, I got to check that out. Jeff, thank you very much for the call. We will be back. Patrick Lovell is going to be with us. He has some ideas that are solution-driven, too. And then a whole bunch of you want to call in and share thoughts on this. We'll continue this topic into the next hour as well. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What would you do if you knew that the human race was facing extinction? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Chuck, watching Free Speech TV in Winterport, Maine. You are a former geology professor, Chuck?
I didn't quite hear what you said.
I said, are you a former geology professor? That's the note I have.
No, but at the University of Chicago in 1960, we were discussing peak oil.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember the author's name. The professor's name was White, but I can't say more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But peak oil, it was a geology professor who had us read a book on it. And his forecast was in the 1990s. Of course, things have changed some since then. But it's not just peak oil now that we're running out of. We're running out of peak minerals.
And water.
And water. And so many other things. And the first Earth Day was in 1970, if I recall correctly.
Yep. I think you're right.
And so knowledge of this should not be new to anyone.
I agree. But it is. And in fact, you still have, big oil companies funding climate deniers, climate change deniers.
Yep.
You still have Fox News running around going, oh my God, it's freezing cold in New York City. It must be global cooling. it's insane. It's really insane.
It's great.
Chuck, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Maine. Aaron, watching Free Speech TV on cable in Seattle. Hey, Aaron, what's up?
Well, I just thought a slightly different perspective might be of interest. We have to start wherever we're at.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever we're at, this is the place that we have to start, and that's the place we have to try to get off the dime on. Your callers are saying, well, yeah, we have to close down the light switches that aren't on. That's absolutely true, but Another possibility is about 30 years ago, we made some solar towers. The solar towers were fairly, they worked. They basically generated a high volume of electricity coming out of them. Mm-hmm. The one solar tower that we had in, I think it was Arizona, might have been New Mexico, was bought by the oil companies to be closed down after it was starting to be copied by the Spanish.
Hmm.
The Spanish put up five of these things to build it because they worked. And sunlight is not one of those resources that's going to...
These units that have a giant array with molten sodium in them, as I recall. And,
yeah.
And they have a couple of acres of mirrors pointing at them, and the mirrors move following the sun, and you heat the giants, the sodium, and it turns a turbine and generates electricity.
Or you can just heat water and
do it with steam.
Sterilize water.
Yeah, yeah. The same way that a nuclear reactor does. In this case, the nuclear reactor is 93 million miles away. We call it the sun.
Yeah, without waste. The other thing I was trying to say was the Arctic outgassing is an interesting thing. If we could harvest the outgassing that's taking place, as opposed to just simply saying, oh, it's outgassing, how terrible.
Yeah. The problem is, I've seen pictures of this, it's just the ocean and now there's a plume that's 150 miles wide, and it's just the ocean looks like soda pop, you know, and the bubbles are just diffuse over this 150-mile area, and it's methane coming up out of the sea floor as the methane hydrate crystals are melting. You can see this if you go to arctic-news.blogspot.com. You can see all this stuff. Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're going to get back to this whole topic of global warming and what would you do in just a moment. But I wanted to introduce you all to Patrick Lovell. He is a filmmaker, writer, producer, and the protagonist of Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. Forward13thefilm.com is the website for it. It debuted last night on Free Speech TV. And Patrick, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thank you so much. It's a bit profound considering the last question you asked before going to break. What would you do if you knew the world was going to end tomorrow? I'm actually sitting right at ground zero at the moment, looking up at the newly refurbished One World Tower, thinking about that same thing.
Hmm. And your thoughts are?
Well, that's why I made the film, Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. It's about... understanding where you've come from to understand where we have to go. And as you know more than anyone else, Tom, the time is now, because if we don't wake up and get this thing figured out quickly, we're not going to have any time left.
Right. Not only do we need an economy, and not only do we need an economy that will sustain a middle class that's not, you know, in constant poverty and fear of want, but we need an economy that's sustainable.
Exactly.
That's environmentally sustainable. And I think personally that the environmental sustainability could be the thing that produces the economy that produces a sustainable middle class. You started out by basically losing everything with the crash of 2008, the Great Bush Depression crash, whatever you call it, the bankster crash, and went from there to make this movie. Tell us about that.
Well, I've been a producer for some time, and I actually was on a television show giving away houses, of all things, for about 2.5 years. Prior to this entire event that became the catalyst for me going on a journey. And what happened was I was starting my own company, and I had the opportunity to start it. I had seed funding from a high net worth individual that was coming on September 15, 2008. That was the day, obviously, that crashed on Wall Street, but it was also the day that revealed itself for what it was. And
that was the day Lehman collapsed, wasn't it?
That was the day Lehman collapsed. And I got buried. My family and I got buried. We were in a subprime home. Although I was making good money at the time, but the fact was we work in a right-to-work state, so you had to do subprime just because of the nature of the paperwork. And we were making great money at the time. But as everybody else experienced, we ended up losing everything. And as a result, my house went through wrongful foreclosure, and the process was just horrible. But what it did was it basically took everything away, and it broke it down to its lowest common denominator. And it sent me on a journey where I found everything that mattered, and that's our film, Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream, which leads to exactly what you're talking about. Because the answer, Tom, has to be the third industrial revolution across the board, whether it's in media, whether it's in energy, whether it's in food sustainability, across the board. And we have the technology to do it, but what's happening at the moment is, you know, better than anybody, that it's a war in the trenches between those, the status quo, the big oil, the big finance, that don't want to change anything because they're doing just fine.
Yeah. Remarkable. And the movie, we're talking with Patrick Lovell. He's the filmmaker, writer, producer, and the protagonist, the star of Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. Forward13thefilm.com is the website. You're going to, you're making your film debut at the Rated SR Socially Relevant Film Festival in New York City today at 5 p.m. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And believe it or not, as you know, if you saw the film, Tom, my family plays a big role in this. And we stuck together and we didn't, get divorced and commit suicide and those things that were pretty relevant as a result of the fact that now we're here together live and well for the premiere of our film. And it's like a dream come true. But I do want to mention just really quickly, because I don't think we have much time, that, Tom, the whole thing is a prologue to what happens next. We created the Everyman Super PAC, and we hope your viewers will find us online at everymansuperpac.com. The idea is we've got to end the revolving door, and we've got an idea on how to do that, and it's all there on our website.
Okay. And say that website again.
It's everymansuperpac.com. It's kind of a tongue-in-cheek sort of approach to the Super PACs and the 501c4s.
Right.
We are a 501c4, but we're trying to put ourselves out of business as quickly as possible.
Right.
We want to be Main Street's answer to the Cokes.
That's great. That's great. And also, I know I see that people can get tickets if they're in New York City to the Quad Cinema, where you're going to be doing a Q&A after the screening today at 5, and it's coming up on 4 right now.
If people had attended Occupy Wall Street, especially, or if you lost your home to foreclosure, I would love to see you there. Get on down. It's at the Quad Theaters in the Village.
Yeah. And ratedsrfilms.org is the website where you can pick up tickets to that. It's also available on Hulu and Amazon and Vimeo. And I'm going to have to watch it this weekend, Patrick. Last night I had after I got off the air, I had a business dinner that I had to go to, and I didn't have an opportunity to watch it on Free Speech TV to watch the debut. So I'm very much looking forward to this, and I'll probably just pick it up on Amazon this weekend and watch it.
Tom, it would be more of an honor than you know if I could ever hear from you personally, because I got to read The Crash of 2016, but I watch you all the time. You're the greatest guy in media, and thank God for you, Tom, because your voice matters, man, and it's just an absolute honor to talk to you, my friend.
Well, thank you, Patrick, and you know, it's a pleasure to have you on the program too. The work that you're doing is really important, and people need to check this out. The movie is Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. How do you describe the American Dream, Patrick?
Well, the American Dream, of course, can be all things to all people. For me, what it means is sustainability and upward mobility. What it means is that if you have an idea to come up with the greatest invention, if you have an idea to get married and own a home, if you have an idea to be in your own business, that all of those opportunities are available to you if you're willing to work hard and make it. But what I learned as a result of 2008, and I can tell you, prior to this, I was the greatest and firmest believer in the American Dream, that anything was possible. I'd never call myself a libertarian, but I certainly believe that you can work hard and make things happen. But since, you know, and I'm standing right here in ground zero, September 2008 revealed to me the real world, like, the fall of the towers. And what it revealed is the emperor wears no clothes, which is everything you've been talking about every time I've listened to you, Tom, which is the billionaires and the revolving door have choked the American Dream. They've got their foot on the American Dream, which means that mobility is dead until we, the people, do something about it.
Yeah. We no longer have an economy. We have an oligonomy. We no longer have a democracy. We have an oligarchy. And,
that's exactly right.
Yeah. And you know, it's the big, you've got six big banks control 65, assets equal to 65% of the GDP of the planet, or of the country, rather. And that ain't good. Patrick Lovell, he is the writer, producer, protagonist, and filmmaker for Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. The website for the film is forward13thefilm.com. And it's opening this afternoon in New York City at the Quad Cinema, but go and check it out. Patrick, thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Be well.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. We will continue our conversation about global warming and the consequences thereof in a few minutes. But I think a subset of this is, you know, one of the largest industries that is producing methane and consuming water in the United States right now is the food industry, in particular the meat industry. And we also find, you know, if you watch fascinating video, Forks Over Knives, that, you know, the Bill Clinton, Henry Kissinger diet is a plant-based diet, entirely plant-based diet, and these people are using this to stop heart disease. It actually reverses heart disease. Every 5 years, the USDA comes out with a new set of dietary guidelines, and they're working on 2015's right now. And Julie Gundlach is quite concerned that they might be, A, suggesting that we should consider a plant-based diet, and which would be a whole lot nicer for the earth, and B, that Kate Clancy, who was billed as a food systems consultant, I'm reading from the Independent Women's Forum guest alert here, came to the podium and explained that the DGAC, the agency that's putting together these recommendations for food, how we eat, must integrate environmental concerns into the guidelines. She called for plant-based diets to contribute to food security and sustainability of land, air, and water. Julie Gundlach with the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. She is the Culture of Alarmism Project Director with the IWF and the author of From Cupcakes to Chemicals. Julie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So why are you opposed to the U.S. Department of Agriculture recommending to us that we eat less meat and that we grow, I guess that's a euphemism, but I don't know the proper word to use, less meat. What's wrong with that?
Well, look, I think it's really important that people consume a lot of vegetables, and I think it's important that they switch to leaner cuts of meat. I agree with them on that, but I'm very concerned about people who live under the poverty level in this country who struggle every day with food costs. I really worry that they are not going to be able to provide their children nutritious meals that meet the calorie requirements. And the bottom line is even the DASH diet, which this committee actually praises, recommends lean meats and does not recommend going to a plant-based diet. It's simply impossible to provide a child the calories they need from, you know, entirely living on nuts and seeds and beans and vegetables.
Well, for what it's worth, not to contradict you, but my wife and I have both been vegetarians since we were 16 years old. We raised all three of our kids as vegetarians. One of our three kids continues to be not just a vegetarian, but has been a vegan for 20 years. And our kids are now 30, 35, and 40, and they're all incredibly healthy.
Well, that's great for
and,
you.
And it's a lot cheaper to eat that way, particularly if you're poor.
I don't agree with that. I think the committee is also recommending going organic, buying locally produced meat, grass-fed beef. These things are more expensive. Tom, I actually just went to the grocery store. I mean, I don't know where you shop. But at the grocery store, those items, organic, local, grass-fed beef, line-caught fish, these things are more expensive. And conventionally produced milk and dairy and meat and vegetables are perfectly fine for people. And we need to be, what I wish that this committee was doing, was advising people on the cuts of meat. For instance, leaner meats and what constitutes, like, using a ground beef that only has 10% fat. these are recommendations that people can really use.
But, Julie, it takes thousands of gallons of water to produce a pound of beef. I mean,
right.
And you know, my experience has been that, yeah, it might be cost more to eat organic beef or line-caught salmon, but why eat either one of them at all? It's a lot cheaper to eat potatoes and broccoli and oatmeal.
But those vegetables do not have the higher protein quality. And
yes,
the
they do.
And the amino acids that only come from
animals. Julie, that science has been completely disproven. I know Frances Moore LePage. She wrote, you know, Diet for a New for a Small Planet back in the 80s, and it was a big hit. And she suggested that, you know, beans don't have tyrosine and rice doesn't have I forget the amino acid, and these are essential amino acids. And but if you combine the two of them, then you get a complete, you know, because there's 8 or 9 amino acids that we don't produce in our body. You get all the essential amino acids. It was 10 years later that E.G. Nasser published a piece called The Amino Acid Homeostasis in the Canine Gut Lumen, in which he inserted a tube into the middle of a dog's small intestine and discovered that the intestinal slurry that was in there, regardless of what you fed the dog, always had a balance of all the amino acids necessary, because 50% of the contents of the gut at any given time, at least the gut beyond the small intestine, is the body recycling itself. The liver, blood cells are dying off at literally millions an hour, and other cells in the body die, and the lining of the stomach and the large and small intestine replaces itself every 3 days. You are constantly adding your own meat to the food. And so it's impossible to produce an amino acid deficiency. There is not a single case anywhere in the world in all of human history of anybody who had that disease that Frances Moore LePage in her book, and she was a writer, not a scientist, by the way, and like I said, I know her. She's changed her tune on these things, that she posited could happen, an amino acid deficiency. The only amino acid deficiency that exists is kwashiorkor. I've seen it. I worked with starving children in Uganda. We took over the Namalo prison farm during the war with Idi Amin. I had 20,000 people who were dying, 300 a day dying. They had the big bellies. But that was starvation.
I think the critical thing we need to remember here is that people, for very little money, can get the nutrients they need out of eating a small amount of lean meats.
They can also get it out of fruits and vegetables.
I know that you say that. You know, your entire family is vegetarian. You clearly make more than people who live under the poverty level, Tom. And so
I haven't all my life, Julie. When Louise and I were first married, we literally saved up all week long to go to Taco Bell to get a vegetarian taco, which was our treat for the week.
That's certainly is a treat. But I'm telling you that I just think that people who live under the poverty line are not going to be able to afford organic milk. I mean, I cannot afford organic milk.
Milk's not good for you.
I can't afford organic vegetables. And so to suggest to the American public that not only do they need to do away with meat in their diets, but then switch to this sort of whole foods type of eating and shopping is absurd.
Well, I'm suggesting it. Organic fruit and vegetables and grains and nuts and seeds are less expensive than even non-organic meats and fish. And they're better for you. You don't get heart disease. You don't get obesity. You don't.
I disagree with you. I think that there are some lean cuts of beef that are very reasonably priced. But the bottom line is this committee is supposed to be making nutrition recommendations. And it is absurd to suggest that Americans should switch all to a vegetarian diet. It's unrealistic. It's not going to happen.
But what if our eating meat is killing our planet, Julie?
Well, I don't agree with that, Tom. I don't agree that the meat industry is turning our planet into, you know, the Blade Runner. I think that the meat industry, and let's not also forget that the food industry has taken billions of calories out of the marketplace. They are providing Americans the choices. Americans can have meat, but they can also have a plant-based diet. That is because the food industry gives us the choices.
It's because we have our gardens, or we should.
What's because we have gardens?
We can have a food-based diet. A plant-based diet.
I can't imagine. I'm a busy mom. I don't have time to grow every fruit and vegetable.
Yeah, neither do I. Neither do I. That was a little too glib by half. My apologies. Julie Gunlock. Julie, you're a good advocate for your cause. IWF.org is the website. She's the author of From Cupcakes to Chemicals and the Culture of Alarmism Project Director for the Independent Women's Forum. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks for having me on.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, if we want to stop the world from collapsing, do we start with a plant-based diet? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Laurel in Adrian, Minnesota, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Laurel, you wanted to talk about Guy McPherson's comments?
Yeah. Yeah, Tom. It's great to talk to you. there was... You know, there's a lot of backlash that he's getting that he, you know, may be overly pessimistic and at pegging our extinction at, you know, 20, 30, 40 years down the road. Mm-hmm. And there's something that I remember if I'm remembering correctly from studying the Permian mass extinction that states that he might actually be optimistic. and based on, from what I know, what I remember from that event. I know it took a long time to play out. It started with the Siberian traps and, it knocked out a good portion of the land animals. Then it moved into the oceans for a while and it warmed up the oceans as it was, wrecking the marine habitat. But there was something about the end of that mass extinction that really has me concerned. And it has to do with the clathrates. It has to do with the methane clathrate release that recent studies are indicating that from the time that methane clathrate release started, that final phase of the extinction event, from the time that clathrate release started, the entire extinction event played itself out, finished itself out within 13 years.
You're thinking not of the Permian extinction, but of a minor extinction, a smaller extinction. It was a 70% instead of a 95% extinction that happened after the Permian. And it's referred to as the PETM, the Permian Eocene Thermal Maximum. And that they've nailed that down just in the last year. The scientists have nailed it down that it was 13 years from the time that the PETM, that the initiating of the methane started until it had raised global temperatures by about 5 degrees and wiped out, 70% of the life on Earth. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's not that. You know, maybe I'm misremembering it, but, from the time the release started to the time it wrapped up was only 13 years. Well, if we're going on that kind of time scale, well, this current methane release started in 2007. That was 7 years ago already.
Yeah.
And, to think, maybe human beings might be resourceful enough to adapt to a long-term change. But if this is a change that is only going to take 6 more years to play itself out to its maximum, I don't see how human beings can be resourceful enough to adapt to a change that is going to be that rapid and that harsh.
Well, it might be random. I mean, this is typically how bottleneck events occur. It'll be that the people who are living in Patagonia and the people who are living in the most northern parts of Canada and Siberia are going to find themselves in a climate that suddenly starts resembling Michigan instead of Patagonia or Siberia. And they'll be the few who make it through. And, it's just natural selection.
When Guy McPherson talks about habitat, it's not necessarily, whether the temperature is being mild or otherwise. It comes down to food.
Yeah.
I mean, the weather could be perfectly nice outside, but if there's no food coming out of the ground, you're going to starve.
Right.
And that's the main concern that I'm having. I mean, it's not like the soil in the, Arctic tundras, is conducive to growing massive wheat and rice crops.
Yeah, yeah. If the Koch brothers, instead of spending hundreds of millions of dollars in trying to stop poverty programs and Obamacare, took that money and spent it on carbon sequestration technologies to undo the damage of the fossil fuel industry that they are right in the center of, I think we'd all be a lot better off. Laurel, thanks a lot for the call. You're spot on. Past the hour, so what should we do with the knowledge that we have that there is a very real possibility? Some would argue a probability. Guy McPherson would argue a certainty. I think it still falls somewhere between possibility and probability that we are in the midst of an extinction event and that that extinction event could include even humanity. What do we do? How do we live our lives? How do we conduct ourselves? What do you do tomorrow? Bob, in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, you've been
thank you, Tom.
Thinking about this for a while?
Yeah. Several decades. Dr. McPherson makes a very good point, a bottom line point that you've made several good points on since then, all of which are good points. The many varied solutions may come from a more random base, but in terms of the political gridlock that we're in, I think there needs to be more discussion of industrial hemp versus Monsanto. In other words, farmers around the world growing industrial hemp to essentially create and recreate economy, manufacturing base, thereby putting more oxygen into the atmosphere and sequestering more carbon from the soil and the atmosphere.
Right. And one of the nice things about that is that you can grow industrial hemp without the use of chemistry. And so that allows the soil to become organic. Organic is a fancy chemistry word for containing carbon, and which means that the soil can once again become rich and thick and dense and filled with carbon, and it can sequester lots and lots of carbon. Rodale is doing some amazing work on this right now. Bob, excellent point. Thanks for the call. Carolyn in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Carolyn.
It's Catherine.
Or Catherine, I'm sorry.
Hi, Tom. Well, I guess ever since I was a little kid, I had a feeling we were coming towards something, and I didn't know what it was. And about 20 years ago, there was a little boy who was a genius on Dateline, and I lived in Denver, Boulder, and he lived there. And he was 11. His mom was waiting till he was 13 to let him go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And his mom said, sometimes he didn't eat or sleep knowing what's coming. And I remember the quote. He said, "It's like the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. No, it's going to be a lot worse." So, you know, I got here to Boulder and all the political, I mean, to Madison and all the political things were happening. And a couple of years ago, I went to hear Van Jones speak. And in the middle of his speaking, he was the gentleman that worked for 6 months at the White House, which
mm-hmm.
means he had clearance.
Right.
At one point, he looks at us and he goes, "Anything you can imagine happening in Madison is nothing compared to what the Pentagon is getting ready for." Okay, well, that could mean a lot of things.
He's right.
And then in 2012, a gentleman came to talk to us. I actually have found his name, and I can send it to you, but I don't feel comfortable. I want to tell you what he said, but he doesn't have it in his books.
Okay.
He's been a consultant to governments in numerous countries, multinational corporations and community organizations, and lots of other things. Mm-hmm. And he was telling us about alternative money systems, people money. And he said, "I've traveled the United States 2.5 times in the last 6 weeks, and I've been into Washington a couple of times. I don't know if I should tell you this, but I'm going to. The CIA thinks that 70% of the world's population will be gone by 2020. Now, I thought I was mishearing, so I went back and checked with people. I said, "Did he say 2020 and 70%? And they said, "Yeah, that's what he said."
6 years from now.
So that would go with that 13-year period, and I think they already know.
Yeah.
I think the oligarchs are too strong. And
what's too strong?
Brave enough to talk about it.
What is too strong?
The oligarchs and the oil companies
yeah.
and the billionaires.
Yeah, and who knows? And they may be building a fortress of solitude like Superman's, you know, in the Arctic or in Patagonia right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I did hear a little thing when I went in for Code Pink in Washington a number of months ago. I stayed at the hostel, and there was a woman there who talked about selling her house and how she was a consultant. She goes to Beijing, and she consults with other consulates. And she said, "Well, the truth is," she says, "there are 14 countries that are planning on having 2 colonies on the moon."
Wow. Yeah, that's I think, not a good solution, but who knows?
It's not a good solution.
You know.
And I don't know if it was a solution to what's going on. I mean, she was just
right.
talking about the privatization of space travel.
Right. It's remarkable. But Catherine, I want to get some more callers in. Thank you for the call and for sharing your stories with us. Tom in Youngstown, Ohio. You think that milk is... I'm fine. You think that milk is good for you?
Yeah. It was just on the news last week. The problem was taking the fats out of the milk.
But you know, here's a simple question, Tom. Why should we, as humans, be drinking the breast milk of another species after we've been weaned? Shouldn't we be drinking human breast milk until we're weaned, until we're a year, 2, 3 years old, whatever's appropriate, and then stop? I mean, isn't that what every other animal, every other mammal on Earth does?
Why did God tell Mary to raise Jesus on milk, honey?
I don't know that he did, and I don't know that,
he,
I mean,
yes, he did.
Okay.
Milk and honey. Milk is good for you. The problem being, when they've gone to the 1%, the 2%, the non-fat,
right,
the omega-6 or omega-3 has been removed.
Right. Well, and there are some concerns that even pasteurized milk has changed the nature of the milk to make it really bad for you, and that if you're going to drink
right,
milk, you should do it like the...
the whole milk, organic.
Like the tribesmen in northern Uganda did. I'm forgetting the name of the tribe. The Karamojong. And that is that they drink it right out of the cow, or out of the goat, actually, mostly. And they also drank the blood, which is interesting. I was there. Tom, thank you for the call. I respectfully disagree. I think that, I have a friend who's Japanese, who lives in Japan, and he once made the comment to me that the way Japanese view cheese, in fact, we went to a pizza place, a pizza hut in Tokyo to get it, and they don't have cheese on the pizzas. He says that's because we think of it as fermented mammary secretions.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This is how the Japanese and Chinese view our eating cheese. Oh, you're eating the rotted secretion of the mammary gland of a large mammal? Really? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very pantophagously ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good! Letitia James, the New York City councilwoman, has proposed a plan that would give all Big Apple students access to free school lunches. Her reasoning is simple. As she told supporters at a recent event outside of New York City Hall, there is a poverty stigma associated with school-provided lunch. We have children standing on two separate lines to get food, those who are paying and those who are not. That is why we're here to announce our plans for free lunch for every public school student to eliminate that stigma. The stigma, she went on to say, prevents many eligible students from participating in the existing school lunch program. A full stomach is the key to a hungry mind. So good on Councilwoman James for trying to make sure that every New York student can get the nutrition they need without fear of ridicule. The bad. Ken Langone, the Home Depot founder and big-time GOP donor, is the latest billionaire to call liberals fascists. He told Politico today that he hopes that economic populism doesn't work, quote, because if you go back to 1933 with different words, this is what Hitler was saying in Germany, end quote. That's right. Ken Langone thinks wanting to raise taxes on rich people is just like calling for the mass murder of religious minorities. What impeccable logic. And the very, very ugly, the Westboro Baptist Church, but not for the reason you might think. Over the weekend, news broke that the church's founder, Fred Phelps, is on his deathbed. And while you'd expect the church to try to honor his legacy as much as possible over the next few days, they probably won't. That's because the ailing Phelps was excommunicated from his own church over the summer for, I kid you not, asking his fellow parishioners to be kinder to each other. That's right, even a dying Fred Phelps, the king of the homophobes, was too nice for the Westboro Baptist Church. And that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Florindo in New York City, what would you do if you knew that the crash was imminent?
Tom.
Yes,
hello?
Sir. You are on the air.
Yes, it's great to be on the air with you. Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to mention to your listeners about the Deep Green Resistance, which is a tome that was written by Derek Jensen and Lier Keith recently, and their thesis is that what we need to do in the 20 to 30 year window that McPherson speaks about is actively and consciously reorganize society and dismantle industrial civilization. And the thing is that because of the oligarchs, in a way, it's going to be kind of easier because we're already sort of shut out of the system. So, you know, it's like, you know, everybody's going to be joining like grassroots organizations that, you know, will be able to act locally. And that's the way we're going to have to do it. But it's got to be a conscious thing, you know, like during the, you know, the after the Depression, when the riot with the unions and that reorganization of society. I mean, there was a lot of word of mouth kind of organizing that went on a local level. And I think that's what we're going to have to be relying on now.
What you're describing is what I predicted in my book, The Crash of 2016.
Well, I'm reading that right now, coincidentally. I'm up to about page 80.
Okay, great. Well, this isn't the last chapter or so, but... but basically that yeah, we need to get past these just all the general insanity of our modern industrial civilization. Derek Jensen is a brilliant writer. I read his first book. I read and blurbed one of his books. It might be a second or third. I didn't know that he had a new one out. I'll have to look for that. I have a lot of respect for anything Derek Jensen writes. So.
His co-author, Liere Keith, is a very interesting thinker. She wrote a book called The Vegetarian Myth, which talks about just the opposite of what your interviewee was saying, that basically we shouldn't be eating vegetables so much as meat, because for a lot of reasons, including the decline of the topsoil. But anyway,
so she's asserting that we should not be eating vegetables.
Correct.
Does she not know that it takes you know, hundreds of pounds of vegetables to be fed to a cow to produce a pound of meat?
Yeah, but you should check her book out. I'm not going to defend her or pretend to be able to explain her theory, but she doesn't think that our society is organized properly, and that's really.
Yeah. I get it with ruminants. You know, if you look at you know, the herders around the world, and I've right. been in those societies, the goats eat things that humans can't eat. They eat grasses and things, and then you eat the goat, or you drink the milk and the blood from the goat until the goat is old and dying, and then you eat the goat. But you know, whatever the case may be, that's a way of extracting sunlight energy, sunlight calories from plants that you can't otherwise eat, and that actually, you know, arguably is quite efficient. But growing soybeans and corn to feed to cows to make meat to eat the meat is insane.
Well, I think she's more in favor of the hunter-gatherer model.
Okay. Well, in that case, I wouldn't disagree, and that's the one. That's the one circumstance under which I think eating meat makes a certain amount of sense. Florindo, thanks for the call. I've got a whole wall full of callers here. I want to get to as many as I can. Thanks. Thank you very much, Mike in Arvada, California, or Colorado rather. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
Can you hear me okay today?
Just fine. So you wanted to talk about flooding and oil well spills?
Yeah, I mean, that went out 100 miles into the plains, and there was pictures of all the spilled oil contamination.
Which spill are you talking about?
From the floods we had just north of here in Boulder.
Oh, okay, the recent floods, right.
Right. And with your knowledge of history and Paul Weyrith and the goo-goo and that syndrome he had, how are we not so sure these guys are not wanting to take over the entire clean water supply eventually?
Oh, they absolutely do want to.
Well, by ruining all our water with their chemicals.
Oh, no, I think that's just externalizing expenses. I that would be too complex a conspiracy theory.
I hope it is.
Yeah, they need us for cheap labor, you know? So
I chewed on it for a while, and the other things I've seen them do, I'm not so sure it is not intentional.
Yeah, well, I suppose anything's possible, Mike. Thanks a lot for the call and for sharing your thoughts. Steve in Aurora, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You wanted to disagree about vegetarianism?
Yes. First of all, I want to thank you for all that you do, and I'm usually in agreement with everything you say.
But
I myself am a recovering vegetarian for 20 years.
Uh-huh.
It's now been 15 years. it is possible to do a vegetarian diet and be healthy, but it's very difficult. And the whole protein issue, I think you addressed quite correctly, as Frances Moore LePage showed in her work. But there are issues with other vitamins, particularly the fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, vitamin K2. But the thing that I really wanted to mention is the work of Alan Savoy and the Savoy Institute, where they're using pasture animals to reverse desertification.
Yeah, I've seen his TED talk, and you know, his claims are exaggerated. He's been fairly adequately debunked in his suggestion that if we simply turned all the soil back to grasslands, it would stop global warming or it'd sequester enough carbon to get us back down to 350 or something like that. But it is an important step, and having ruminants out there, you know, producing grasslands and having a more balanced ecosystem does make a lot of sense, but that doesn't mean we have to eat them.
Well, there's an argument for another day. The real problem,
well, Steve, you should check out a video. If you want to go down this road, you should check out a video that is titled Wolves. Just Google Wolves and Rivers over on YouTube. Wolves bring back the rivers, or wolves change the course of rivers. And it's a brilliant thing about what happens if you allow the ruminants to live normally and you put normal predators, wolves, into that environment rather than human predators, and you know how it revitalizes the ecosystem.
Sure, I don't doubt that. I don't think there's any historical precedent for being vegetarian. And I think
3,000 years of Buddhism?
They ate dairy products.
Not always. A lot of Asians don't eat dairy products. So the Hindus eat dairy products, and they've been vegetarian for 5,000 years. But they eat ghee and milk and like that. But not so much in China. I've eaten in a lot of vegetarian restaurants from Beijing all the way down to Taipei, which, of course, is Taiwan, not China, but still. And they do not use dairy products at all. They're entirely plant-based.
And I just want to say that the woman from the Independent Women's Forum is just making ridiculous arguments.
Well, this is the conservative argument, and there's you know, a lot of people who make that argument and who are horrified that our government is telling us how to eat healthy, and even worse, that they might say, add more plants to your diet. It's got to be a terrible thing. Steve, thank you for the call. Seriously, though, I'm serious. If you go to YouTube, and I'm going to do it during the break, not during this break, but the top of the hour, but go to YouTube and plug in Wolves Change Rivers, and I'm guessing that this will pop up for you. It's an amazing video to watch. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls, your thoughts. Oh, and we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, too, in a few minutes, find out what's going on in the world. And then we'll get back to what would you do if you thought the world was going to end. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Dave in St. Paul, Nebraska, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I regarding the lady that talked about the CIA plans for our mass extinction here, I was lucky enough to have a conversation with Ray McGovern, the ex-CIA agent, 30
right.
years.
Yeah, I know service. Ray. He's been on the program a number of times.
Great. He'd be a good get for the show.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was saying that the current crop of the CIA agents are bat guana crazy, and nothing would surprise him on their plans for our future.
Yeah. Well, I think that they war game pretty much every possible scenario. They have to plan for what would happen, for example, if we got into a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. Well, that would probably wipe out 90% of human life on Earth. What would happen if we went to war with China and it went nuclear? Ditto. What happens if the methane starts melting in the Arctic? You know, I mean, they game out all of these things because they view themselves as the protectors and arbiters of the planetary systems. And so anyway.
Well, I hope it's protectors and not the
instigators.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that they would not be tied in with the rapture crowd, too.
Yeah. If you look at what's going on at the Air Force Academy, that's pretty scary stuff. Dave, thanks for the call. Ed, in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what do we need to do to prepare for the end of the world?
Well, we need to contact our elected representatives and work within the system. We need to throw everybody out of the Antarctic and conquer it for America because it's going to be the last place where people can live.
That's
we need to take it now while we have lots of aircraft carriers and nobody else can match us.
But why us? What if we're not the most? What
why
if we're not the
America,
most adapted?
Why shouldn't America survive?
Well, you know, what if it should be instead, you know, an Aboriginal tribe in northern Canada or in the mountains of Ecuador, you know, that has for the last 500 years been living sustainably? Might they not be better adapted to live sustainably in Antarctica?
Well, good luck to them, but we have the military to take what we want. That's the way it works. That's the way the world works. We can all sit around and sing Kumbaya, but that ain't going to make it happen.
Ed, are you making this suggestion with tongue-in-cheek, or are you serious?
I'm serious. I think the first thing we should do before we grab Antarctica is conquer Canada, because we're going to need that land before the Antarctica melts. We're going to need to live in Canada.
Yeah, northern Canada. Well, we've got Alaska.
Yeah.
You know, we need to have a conversation with Sarah Palin.
Well, we can't put 300 million people in Alaska. We need Canada.
Yeah, well. Well, if we took our birth rate to zero, of course, this is happening faster than a couple of generations. That's not going to help a lot.
We need to work with our system. Only knows one thing, and that's military force and military might. And if you tell them to go with it, they will.
You think we could cow the Canadians pretty quickly?
Oh, we could conquer them in a day and a half.
Yeah, and look at what we did in Mexico back in 1840.
Absolutely.
So, you know, President Polk taught us how.
Not a good idea.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Ed, you may be serious. I'm tongue-in-cheek about this, but it's an interesting thought. And one I'm sure that is being war-gamed by the Pentagon right now. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Coming up next, Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service will be with us, filling us in on the news of the day. Stick around. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, and brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, with my favorite ex-congressman and one of my favorite authors. He wrote a brilliant book called Sideswiped, Bob Ney of the Talk Radio News Service. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. What is going on in the world today, Bob?
Well, there's a lot going on, actually, in the world, in the sense of course, the issues continue with Crimea and the vote. And now, today, President Putin has said that, you know, he's accepted it. It has to go through constitutional court process in Russia, which I don't think will be particularly of a problem. I think it's going to go, you know, Tom, into the negotiation stages at this point in time, more or less with the European Union that has a lot more sway, frankly, you know, than the United States does on this whole issue. And then on to, of course, the plane is just about where it still was, and not knowing what on earth has particularly happened, just a lot of speculation. The big news, too, I think it's a big deal, is the meeting in Vienna with Iran and also the United States, Russia, which we will be talking at the same table, at least with Russia there, China, France, Britain, and Germany.
Hmm.
And that has began today, and it's the 18th and 19th, and there's some instructions the United States senators, 83 senators, have signed a letter that they've given to the president of what they want. But I think this is a huge deal for the world, and a lot of people have a lot of hopes.
So what's the meeting in Vienna about? Again?
This is a second and really significant meeting in the process of where Tehran goes with the uranium enrichment.
Uh-huh. Was this organized by the UN?
This was agreed to by the UN, but this is really the initiative of President Obama.
Uh-huh.
And so today, the subject of the meeting...
With the help of Vladimir Putin, right?
I'm sorry, what's that?
With the help of President Putin.
Oh, yes. Russia is a significant player
right.
in this process. And that's like I said, today, Russia and America will be talking at least at the same stable. Right. Russia is a huge part of this entire Iranian deal that's out there, and China and Britain are also at the table. So,
right.
But President Obama, this is an issue he's had a lot of criticism for, but as he told the Congress, the president said, look, you know, just give me 3 or 4 months. What can it harm after 30-some years?
Right.
So this is it's going to be a significant meeting.
Yeah. I find it very interesting that Russia didn't say anything when we invaded Afghanistan or when we invaded Iraq, more importantly, without the permission of the United Nations. In fact, over the objections of the United Nations for the first 6 months. And yet we're willing to get in their face over Crimea, where they've got about a third of their fleet stationed. I mean, they've got this long history there. We had no history that we could point to with regard to Iraq, certainly. I'm hopeful that we don't blow up a relationship that could be very productive.
This going in the path of, like, some of the people screaming, you know, McCain's of the world, et cetera, you know, and trying to initiate a Cold War is absolutely something that, you know, the government needs to avoid. And I agree with you. And Secretary of State Kerry, when he mentioned about, you know, invasion, a lot of people, I think, that obviously voted for the big lie in America of the invasion of Iraq, including yours truly, cringe when we hear our country criticizing somebody else about an invasion when we invaded over something that didn't exist.
Right. And plus, you know, we didn't go to Iraq after they held an election asking us to come.
That's correct.
You know, I mean, it's somewhat different.
You know, few little differences. And then President Putin did point out where we didn't say much about Kosovo. We didn't say much about the Sudan, the West,
right.
Meaning the West.
Yeah.
So it was brought up.
No, we actually supported the rebels in Sudan in breaking away from
yes,
the North.
Yes, we did.
Although
and
the North was behaving very badly in Darfur, but that was not South Sudan. Darfur is still,
right, that's correct.
Still an autonomous, semi-autonomous region that is associated with the North, not the South. So
that's right. So it's going to be, you know, an interesting process now. It's more time of talk. There's not going to be, I don't think anybody's, in fact, the market went up today based on President Putin's acceptance of the vote. So the market actually went up.
In other words, the situation is stabilizing, so let's get back to work and make money.
That's correct. There you go.
Yeah.
Speaking of stabilization, the Obamacare enrollment hit 5 million.
Well, that's good.
So it's nearing the goal. There'll be some glitches along the way, but obviously people said it would never get to this point. So now it has hit 5 million in the enrollment. And the big economic news, I think, to watch is what's going on today. And this is really being focused and looked at by all the economists, and that's Janet Yellen, the chair of the Fed. She chairs her first meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, and that is today and Wednesday.
And the Fed Open Market Committee is the group that decides whether or not to scale back QE, quantitative easing, right?
That's right. And so if we look at the first thing, I think that Chair Yellen will be changing or maybe abolish is the unemployment, what they call the threshold of 6.5%. And that was a reference point, you know, that interest rates wouldn't be touched. And they created that 6.5% threshold.
Right.
So it's unemployment's at what, 6.7.
Right.
So they're wondering what she will do with it. But I think all eyes are going to be upon her.
Yeah, but and this is because when the Fed was created back in 1913, it was given two mandates in the authorizing legislation. One was to maintain unemployment levels at a fairly low level. To have, you know, a reasonably low level of unemployment. The other was to have a fairly low level of inflation. And during the Greenspan years, they completely ignored unemployment. In fact, Alan Greenspan famously said in the Wall Street Journal that it was his job to maintain a certain necessary minimum level of worker insecurity so there wasn't what he called wage inflation. And so he would jack up the interest rates every time the economy started to heat up. But it sounds like Yellen is taking that dual mandate more seriously.
I think she is, and she's getting back to what the really that intent was, which he had ignored.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Bob's book is Sideswiped, and it's brilliant. Check it out. Bob, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in our first hour. Guy McPherson, Dr. Guy McPherson of the University, formerly of the University of Arizona, was with us. He has a blog, Nature Bats Last, is his blog, and also writes over at arctic-news.blogspot.com. And he was suggesting, he wasn't suggesting, he was asserting that we have now passed over 30 major tipping points with regard to the climate, the majority of them, more than 20 of them, in the last 3 years, and that as a consequence of this, a major extinction is coming, which will probably take the human race with it in as little as 30 years. Now, that's pretty on-the-edge stuff. And it should be noted that the same professor back in 2006 suggested in print, in fact, it's on his website, that by 2008, peak oil and peak water were going to hit, and communities like Tucson, Arizona, where he lived, were going to be thrown into chaos. And so, you know, his prediction record is not stellar, but the science that he's quoting is pretty solid. The conclusions are his. The individual scientists who come up, who have identified these various tipping points, though, they're all, everything pretty much he's quoting is out of Nature or Science, you know, one of the peer-reviewed publications. So I asked the question a couple of hours ago, what would you do if you knew that in 30 years there would be no more humans? How would you conduct your life starting, say, tomorrow? And what could we or should we be doing? Because there are a number of people in the kind of middle ground who assert that if we just dial back industrial civilization a lot, if we start reducing carbon emissions by 10-15% per year, which is a huge amount, but if we started doing that now, that we might be able to avoid that apocalyptic scenario. So I'm going to pick up your calls on that. I also want to go off on a rant about a caller that I had yesterday, except my rant just vanished, that, you know, about useful idiots. And it turns out there's a lot of useful idiots in America. Yesterday, a caller into this show called and echoed Congressman Paul Ryan's recent comments, blaming the black community basically for poverty in America. He threw out a phony Fox so-called news statistic arguing that, and I quote, 73% of African-American women in this country ages 17 to 35 have children without a man in the house, and the majority of this group of people lives in the cities. Well, first of all, that's not true. According to the most recent government statistics, 72% of black babies are born to unmarried mothers today. But that's a completely different thing from saying that 73% of African-American women in this country have a child without a man in the house. It's a completely different thing. That would only be true if 100% of African American women had babies and only had one. But if half of African-American women don't have babies, then your 73% becomes half of that, which is, what, 46.5, 47%. And if they have two children, then that becomes half of that, which becomes 25. So, you know, you can see this is a perfect demonstration of the old saying often attributed to Mark Twain that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. In fact, the birth rate for unmarried black women in America has been falling for almost 40 years, and most of the evidence points to changes in unmarried birth rates among both black and white women in America, a drop that started in the 1970s for both groups, coinciding with the legalization of abortion and the beginning of widespread use of oral contraceptives. This just basically changed the dynamic of marriage in America. And that number, that variable of the percentage of women in both races who have children out of wedlock has been largely unaffected over the years by some really big swings in our welfare programs. So why is it that conservatives, like yesterday's caller and Fox so-called News' useful idiots and Congressman Paul Ryan, why is it that they're obsessed with the notion that blacks and the black community are responsible for poverty in America? Well, there's actually an answer to that question. Like so much that's wrong with America today, it all started with Ronald Reagan. Reagan is famous for his speeches and his one-liners about welfare queens, but as author Ian Haney Lopez pointed out in an interview on Moyers and Company, it really all began with Reagan's earliest welfare stump speech back in 1980 when he was running for president. Reagan would speak to white Americans and say something along the lines of, "I understand how frustrating it is for you when you're standing in line at a grocery store waiting to buy a hamburger and there's some young fellow ahead of you waiting to buy a T-bone with food stamps." But as Lopez points out, the first time Reagan gave that stump speech, young fellow was replaced with young buck, a racially coded term for a young black man. Basically, Reagan was telling white Americans that they're being taken advantage of by blacks on food stamps and that it was made possible by the government taking their money through taxes and then giving it to undeserving black people. So in response to the outrage that Reagan drummed up, he suggested his infamous tax cuts, dropping the top rate that billionaires pay from 74% down to 28%. After all, he told middle-class voters, who got a very small income tax cut, by the way, why should you pay taxes to a government that's just turning around and giving that money to undeserving black people who are using it to eat fancy steak dinners? This is really similar to the recent outrage over at Fox so-called News about people on food stamps buying crab and lobster. Something that's possible, but so rare it has no effect on the overall tax we all pay for food stamps. Lopez goes on to say that for the past 50 years, Republicans have been telling white Americans that the biggest threat to their lives are minorities. And the minorities have taken over government and are eating up all the money. I mean, just last week, Congressman Paul Ryan went on Bill Bennett's Morning in America program and said, and I quote, "We have got this tailspin of culture in our inner cities in particular of men not working and just generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work. And so there's a real culture problem here that has to be dealt with." In other words, Paul Ryan was saying that lazy black men in the inner cities are responsible for poverty in America. And so for some 50 years now, Republicans have been using race baiting tactics and dog whistle politics like this to convince Americans that the black community is behind poverty in this country, and frankly, that's just not true. I mean, you can see many of the same trends in the largely white Appalachia region of the United States as you do in the minority-heavy inner cities. In Appalachia, white Americans are struggling with poverty and having children out of wedlock, just like their black inner-city counterparts. And according to the Pew Research Center's Social and Demographic Trends Project, in 2012, the median net worth of a white household was $91,400 in the United States, while the median net worth of a black household was $6,400. So a black child starts out at a very different place than a white child, both economically and socially. But conservatives still argue that blacks are behind poverty in America. The social and cultural problem that we see in black communities across America and in white communities in Appalachia are responses to poverty, not the causes of it. It's time for Americans and lawmakers in Washington to wake up and start talking about the real causes of poverty in America, which include massive inequality produced by our tax code, joblessness produced by our trade policies, and ongoing discrimination by a largely white economic and political power structure. And only when we start having that conversation about what's really going on in this country. Only then will every American have an equal shot at the American dream, regardless of their race. And an American dream, by the way, that I would add, oh, and in fact, just an hour or so ago, we had a conversation with Patrick Lovell. If you are in New York City, this is yesterday's one sheet. Where'd it go? Here it is. If you are in New York City, any minute now, down at the Quad Cinema, it actually started about 15 minutes ago, but you can still make your way down there. The Rated SR, Socially Relevant Film Festival, is happening in New York City today, and at 5 o'clock, Forward 13 is playing, and it's about recapturing the American dream in a way that makes sense. How do we have a sustainable American dream?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Patrick Lovell's website, by the way, is forward13thefilm.com. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michael, watching Free Speech TV in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, food banks in Norway?
Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Hartman? I just wanted to weigh in on your extinction topic. I'm sure you know, I think you know, that there's a seed bank, an ark, being built in Norway. And I just wondered, this is the end game of the 0.01%, these Wetiko-based rich people. I mean, the Koch brothers are not going to survive this game the same way that me and you are going to survive this game, because they're building fortresses and sanctuaries and seed banks. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the Koch brothers are also, I think, in their 70s. And so they're, I mean, you know, we're all mortal. And I also wonder how much, not just of Guy McPherson, but, you know, how much of the instinct to predict Holocaust, to predict disaster, how much of that comes out of our own recognition of our own humanity, and it's just projection. We're projecting our own death out onto the canvas of the world.
And right, but in the Native American culture, people don't want death amongst each other. You know, like they just said, when Wetiko happened in the Native American tribes, they try to kick you out of the tribe. We
right.
can't kick these billionaires out of the tribe no more. They've got the game.
Well, maybe we can. I mean, you know, the Occupy movement is producing a political party. So
I got you.
You know, I mean, they're going to roll this thing out in the next month.
One last question. Hmm. Once this fall happens, what's going to happen to the M1A2 Abrams tank and the B2 stealth bomber, and who's going to be controlling them?
I'm more concerned about what's going to happen to the nuclear power plants, that if they don't cool, their cores melt down and blow up.
Gotcha. All right, with electricity goes off, you're right. It's not going to happen. Correct. Yep.
That's a really big concern.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Michael. Good to hear from you. This is something that we really need to take seriously. Is you know, what are we going to do about nuclear power plants? If we're looking at or even discussing the possibility of the end of industrial civilization, you know, the Egyptians left behind pyramids and things. The pyramids are not radioactive. Our nuclear power plants are. Aaron in Bushnell, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Aaron, what's up?
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call. I just want to commend you on seeking the truth. My dad, I'm 26. My dad, 10 years ago, got me into the truth movement with the big lie on 9/11. He's a real big fan of Alex Jones. He said that you claimed to believe in the death and resurrection and the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And first of all, I know you're not a religious on the air, but first of all, I would say on the topic of the extinction, I think that's the first thing we want to do is get in line with the creator of the universe and say, okay, God, where are we going to go when we die?
Because, well, if you want to look at this from a religious point of view, Revelation has a few words to say about what's coming.
Absolutely. Besides that, though, on another note, politically and even socially, I think the next best thing is we need to get together as communities. We need to look into our own hearts, I think. Maybe start opening up food pantries and
start growing food in our own backyards. I'm with you, Aaron. Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Definitely start growing food in our own backyards. It's amazing. I mean, you visit other countries of Europe. When I used to live in Germany, pretty much every home had a, you know, their front yard was a vegetable garden. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, you wanted to discuss climate change?
Yes, I do. I'm an optimist. And in order to reverse climate change and stave off either the end of civilization or of the human race, it's going to take a near universal revulsion against the present oligarchs of oil, gas, and coal, and their wholly owned subsidiary, the Republican Party. But fortunately, I think that's going to happen, and I think it's going to happen very soon. And I'll tell you why. We haven't had an El Nino in the Pacific Ocean for about 10 years.
Right, and they come in 11 to 13-year cycles.
That's right. And as a result of that, we've had a slowing down of global warming.
Right.
It is predicted to happen this summer.
Right. If I could just, for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about, an El Nino event is when the ocean, particularly along the our Pacific coast, the eastern Pacific, the eastern coast of the Pacific Ocean, which is on the west coast of North and South America, when it the ocean actually begins to release heat. And what the ocean has been doing for the last decade has been aggressively storing heat. Between 80 and 90% of all the excess heat that we're producing and our planet is acquiring, and it's on the order of 6/10 of a watt per square meter, which is the equivalent, according to James Hansen, of 400,000 Hiroshima bombs going off every day, 365 days a year. That much extra heat is being stored right now because we're at 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. and it's going into the ocean. When you have an El Nino event, the ocean starts releasing that heat along the West Coast, and it produces massive heat waves, drought, and you know, the things associated with drought across the United States.
Yeah, it's an
not to mention wild weather.
And an upwelling of the cold waters in the bottom of the ocean to the top. And
right.
It's going to mean that if it happens, and it probably will, because they have better methods of predicting it now than they have in the past, the polar ice cap is going to melt even more than it did a couple of years ago. We're going to have a record polar ice cap. We are going to have climate catastrophes that are absolutely unprecedented, and that's a good thing. The reason that it's a good thing is because it's going to wake people up worldwide. It's even going to wake people up in the United States.
Yeah.
And the revulsion against the oligarchs who have been denying it is going to be on the level of the revulsion against Mussolini at the end of the Second World War in Italy. And you know what they did to him?
Yeah, they hung him upside down, and they hung him, and then they hung his body upside down in the city square there.
Yeah, they cut open his stomach, cut off his testicles, and stuffed his testicles into his stomach when he was hanging upside down.
Yeah.
That's the kind of revulsion that it is going to take, which will require a 2/3 cut in the military budget worldwide, and all of that money is going to have to be devoted to research and development in solar and wind and conservation.
And sequestration.
Yeah, and yes.
And one of the most aggressive and successful sequestration technologies we don't even have to invent. It's called organic farming.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And organic farming, and if you do it properly, it doesn't deplete the soil. In fact, it grows the soil.
That's right. And it sequesters carbon in the soil.
Yeah.
All that organic material in the soil is called organic because it contains carbon. So, yeah, excellent point, Lawrence. And very well said. I completely agree with you. And I've been watching the science on this coming El Nino, and I think it's going to be a whopper. But, you know, if not this summer, then next summer. But the one thing that might hold it off is that we've been at solar minimum for the last few years, and we're heading back towards solar maximum. But this solar maximum seems to be a lot weaker than the one was 12 years ago. And there seems to be a correlation between those and the El Ninos as well. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. Lawrence, thanks a lot for the call. David in Portland. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to thank you for having Guy McPherson on your show. You know, I think you cover a lot of relevant stuff on your show, but, and this is a big but,
I think Guy McPherson, what he has to say, is probably one of the most important things. It is the most important thing that we can focus on. I first became aware of this guy a couple of years ago, this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But, the Twin Sides of the Fossil Fuel Coin was a key video that I saw by him, that which just made you look at everything differently. And I've been asking that question people a lot lately. What would you do if you knew that we had, you know, 5 more years?
Right.
Or 10 more years, and it's hard to know what to do with the system we have right now. Another video that I saw that just opened my eyes a lot was something by Moyers just recently, and maybe it was Bob Nay that was on the show. He was talking about the anatomy of the deep state.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that?
I didn't.
Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Well, it's definitely worth watching, and I think it's very recent on Moyers. But it's basically how our government really works, and I think we have these oligarchs and oligarchic centers of power.
Right. The NSA being one of them.
State.
And the Pentagon being one of them, certainly.
Yeah, the Pentagon being one of them. Well, this is key because I think the Joint Chiefs of Staff have accepted reality here with climate change, and they've come out, and I've read a lot of pieces recently about how they see this climate change as real and as the biggest threat of all. And I think that, you know, I don't think that the possibilities, I don't think the probability of survival is very good, but if there is a way, it would have to be through something, through the most massive industrial complex that we have, which would be the military industrial complex. They would have to take a leading role in
that. Would be interesting, you know, turning the beast upon itself. David, thanks for the call. That would be very interesting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yeah, this could very much be the equivalent of Ronald Reagan's comment about how, you know, we'd all get together if we knew that the space aliens were coming to get us. Well, you know, we're coming to get us, and we've done this thing with global warming. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting story, the Koch brothers, multi-billionaire libertarians, are setting up, apparently they're using now nonprofit trusts rather than nonprofit corporations to hide their money and conceal what they are doing in the political arena from the average person, at least according to the story over at Raw Story. Let's see if this is reprinted from someplace. Yeah, this originally was published in ProPublica or ProPublica. I'm not sure which it is. And Ralph Reed, David Edwards writing over there at Raw Story, Ralph Reed says, the best solution for food stamps, this food stamp crisis, is to make it harder for women to get divorces. He says, I personally think that the no-fault divorce revolution in the 60s and 70s has not been good for society. Do we really want to make it easier for a man to discard the wife of his youth than it is for him to fire his secretary? For him to basically go in and say goodbye when 40% of all child support is never paid? So he's saying that men shouldn't be able to easily divorce their wives, but, you know, it works for both sides. But he's got his frame and he's sticking to it. Bizarre. But these are small issues compared to the end of the life on Earth. John in Tujunga, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, John, what's up? Social responsibility?
Yes. I'm concerned, like you and many of your listeners, I'm assuming you, that, you know, the people of this country, let alone the world, have been divided intentionally because people do already have the power, but because of the division, they don't have the control. Now, the division of the, by using this welfare propaganda and stuff of which you're speaking, is one of the things, the divide and conquer, is what I'm concerned with. And the most recent example of the divide and conquer that's been going on has, for example, been Condoleezza Rice saying in California to take everything back, need to focus on the core principles of personal responsibility.
Right.
And when I hear that, all I think of is, hey, I got mine. You try to get yours. to heck with everybody else. It's all just personal.
That's exactly what it means.
And the social responsibility concept, core principle, if you will, thank you, Condi, needs to be discussed more out there in your show and Pacifica, KPFK. I do believe the solutions are easy if the solutions are pointed out, and I think this is one solution to the problem. People need to hear more about the social, and instead of all the anti-social capitalism that's been going on across the face of the world.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating that, for example, when Paul Ryan came out with his budget that slashes the social safety net spending, that creates more division in America, that makes America less of a socially responsible country, that it got all kinds of coverage in the media. And that when the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which actually has more members than Paul Ryan's Tea Party Caucus and you know, more solidarity among their members, came out, Raul Grijalva and Keith Ellison came out, rolled out this progressive budget that not only balanced the budget but also strengthened our social safety net, dials back our military. That it, you know, I mean, I covered it on this program. We had Keith Ellison on, as I recall, about it. We had Peter DeFazio on about it, and we had Mark Pocan on about it. But it did not get, I mean, no Sunday morning show touched it. Nobody touched it in the corporate media because, hey, it's the Progressive Caucus, and, you know, they're anti-corporate, so why should the corporate media go after it? But I'm with you, John. I think that social responsibility is the key to everything. And, yeah. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to make a comment on greenhouse gases. You talked about the greenhouse gases, the extra greenhouse gases, ruining our planet there. And well, there's solid state refrigeration now. If you Google the words thermoelectric refrigeration, thermoelectric refrigeration.
Right.
These are solid-state devices that were originally used for scientific instruments, to cool scientific instruments, but they can also be used and are used for refrigeration.
It's like the reverse, the piezoelectric effect?
Yes, yes. And this can easily take the place of refrigeration, so that we know what's the technology for that.
Fascinating. Then we could do away with the chlorofluorocarbons that, you know, now they've identified just in the last few weeks. There was a press release. They've identified three new CFCs that are being released in large quantities and have been for the last few years that are starting to open the ozone hole back up again now that we banned the old CFCs.
I know. Well, thermoelectric refrigeration may be the answer to solving that. And we have to, I think, on the other issue there, we have to see ourselves as earthlings. And we're all citizens of the world, even though we're always playing the flag game. The corporations want us to play the flag game. But they themselves are multinational,
right.
And whatever country they're in, they wrap themselves in the flag.
Yep.
And so we have to start thinking global here. And an interesting fact is, I'm looking at an article that says mobile internet devices will outnumber humans in 2013. It says smartphones, tablets, laptops, internet capable phones, cell phones will exceed the number of humans. So the thing is that I see us now as entangled. We're the nervous system of the world is entangled electronically, and I think that if we realize that we're all entangled and that we're earthlings together, I think we can take advantage of this and maybe, you know, even like save the planet. And there is, you've heard of Jill Stein, right? Have you heard of her?
Oh, I've interviewed Jill many times. She ran for president on the Green Party ticket last. In fact, I moderated one of the debates.
Uh-huh. Well, I heard her on a radio show yesterday, and she has a website going called greenclimateconvergence.org. Globalclimateconvergence.org. Globalclimateconvergence.org. And that's a group of organizations that see themselves more on the global level, and it's to do with Mother Earth and saving us. So I think that's a good place
That's a great place to start. She's a very, very smart woman. She's a physician as well, and boy, does she! I would pay attention to Jill Stein. Harvey, thanks for the heads up on that. Umberto in Hialeah, Florida. Hey, Umberto, what's on your mind today?
Well, I, in relation to everything that's being talked about today, global warming, income inequality, and all of these social and economic injustices that we're facing, what's it going to take to solve all of that or to make it through all of that? Let me share with you what happened to me just the other day. I happen to be a democratic socialist, very progressive, very social justice oriented. My brother, although he would like to deny it, and he does deny it, he is very far into the right wing. The type of person that looks at Fox News and what they spew over there is religious gospel. We had a knockdown, dragged out debate on many different issues the other day. And it didn't matter what we talked about, healthcare, the economy, social justice, the environment and global warming, no matter what issue we talked about, he always approached it only from the point of view of the rights of the rights of business and the rights to make money and profit, and he said that everything I said would hinder the right of business people to keep making more.
Yeah, this is a guy with a Stockholm syndrome, you know? He's identifying with his captors.
Well, here's the thing. We both come from a very poor and working class background, so I'm sorry to have to say I don't know how he evolved to where
he probably started listening to right-wing talk radio. That's the gateway drug.
Well, all I know is that personally, from very young, he was always very materialistic. That's probably where it came from. But anyway, my point is that as a democratic socialist, I believe that the only way that we're going to solve the problems we're facing, including global environmental destruction or injustice, and create a more just and more stable society, is if we start realizing, hey, we have to look out for the well-being of other human beings first and of our planet as a whole. Mm-hmm. We are not made up of 6 or 7 billion individual loners just existing by themselves. We are a human family, and all of our problems have to be solved together and with the best interests of everyone in mind. And that means giving up on this obsession for profit, for how much I can make off of your needs, because I'm sorry, but I told my brother, you have a predatory mentality. Okay, you only look at people from the point of view of how much money and wealth I can make off of others. How about saying, you know, what can I do to make other people's lives better? How can I contribute back to erasing all of the injustices and inequalities and destruction that we as human beings have caused on ourselves over so many years?
Yeah, Maggie Thatcher was wrong, you know, when she famously said there is no such thing as society, there are only individuals clustered together. It all is society, and we are the individual pieces of it.
Exactly, and the only thing that he could say in frustration was, you know, all that you're saying is your socialist mentality and your socialist propaganda. And you know what I told him? I said, calling me socialist is probably the most beautiful compliment that you could possibly give to me, because socialist is not a bad word. It comes from the word social, meaning all human beings working together.
There you go.
For the betterment of all of us.
Well said, Umberto. And good luck with your brother. Good luck. I went through that with my father most of my life. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what would you do if you knew the world was going to come to an end, or the human race was going to come to an end in 20 or 30 years? What would you do tomorrow? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Johnny, watching Free Speech TV in Vacaville, California. Hey, Johnny.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for
I was listening earlier when you spoke about, I think, Paul Ryan's remarks about if only the people in the inner cities would get jobs and wouldn't stop being so lazy and all that,
right. They
wouldn't need welfare. Well, I'd like to point out, I think that was a racist comment to start with, since many inner city poor neighborhoods are people of color.
Well, that was the
Secondly,
whole point.
I'd like to point out that many of the people who live in inner cities are targeted by the war on some drugs.
Mm-hmm. And
prosecuted for the war on some drugs and rated for the war on some drugs, whereas white communities wouldn't be.
Well, and they're prosecuted for it. You know, black drug use and white drug use in the United States is about identical. But African Americans are 800%, eight times more likely to go to jail as a result of using drugs as are white people.
I'm just finishing up The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
And I've cried off and on through this book. It's a tragedy. And I think she calls in the end for something like the gentleman called in about becoming globalists. We are all on the human race. And caring for one another across races and across boundaries.
What does Michelle Alexander suggest is...
in my life as a youth. And I think loving thy neighbor as thyself was one of the top things that Jesus was teaching us.
Yes.
When he was here. So I wanted to call and say that I was so outraged that Paul Ryan would say that.
Well, Johnny, what is the new Jim Crow that Michelle Alexander is writing about in her book of that title?
The new Jim Crow is that the effects of the war on some drugs,
mm-hmm.
the so-called war on some drugs,
right.
that is the drug society doesn't want us to have, not alcohol or tobacco. Those are okay, and sugar's just fine. Coffee's okay. But anyway, that the effect of the war on drugs is affecting the black and brown communities much more heavily than the white communities because yeah. these committees are targeted when the, for example, the stop and frisk policy in New York City.
Yep.
That's done on a racial basis.
Yep.
It's racial profiling, plain and simple. And Michelle Alexander points out how Supreme Court justifies that, has allowed that. And I find that appalling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that it's created a new caste system because these are people now who not only would be discriminated against in the work community and have difficulty finding jobs in their local community, but also have to answer to questions, have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Right. And unlike the Indian caste.
Every single one.
And unlike the Indian caste system where everybody pretty much looks the same, you can't escape from this caste system because you can't escape your DNA. The color of your skin follows you wherever you go.
And because of segregation, which still exists in our communities,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, we still have neighborhoods we know are predominantly black and predominantly
yeah.
white.
Yeah, it's not de jure, it's de facto. Yeah.
And both the black communities, the brown communities, and the poor communities are all targeted.
Yeah.
And the people
right.
of color get the double whammy. They're poor and black and poor and white and brown.
Yeah, you're right. Johnny, thank you for the call. And thanks for sharing that about Michelle Alexander's new book. I'm going to have to check it out. 10 minutes before the hour, we'll be back with more of your calls right after this. The place where despair is not an option, the Tom Harbin Program. Welcome back. No, I am fundamentally an optimist. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Thank you, Tom. I have to second one of your callers' recommendation of a book, Deep Green Resistance.
Okay.
One of the authors, McBay, is the author of Peak Oil Survival.
Okay.
So people might want to pick that up. I'm calling because... Russia was the linchpin country of the USSR 60 years ago when Khrushchev gave the Crimea to the Ukraine.
Right.
And now Russia is moving to annex Crimea. And yesterday I listened to you, and you were speaking with Ellen on the talk radio news, and you said you can't quite fathom why the United States is so involved.
Well, I have one theory, but it's a fairly weak one, and that is that back in November, Reuters published a news story about how Chevron, an American oil company, had signed a $10 billion fracking oil and gas extraction exploration deal with the Yanukovych, with the president of Ukraine. And so there's a $10 billion American interest in Ukraine. But that doesn't seem like enough to go to war with Russia over.
Well, that's certainly half of what I was going to mention, in which this Chevron development would threaten Russia's European sales,
sure,
which is a direct threat to Russia. The other multinational corporations that need to be looked at in regards to the Ukraine are the agribusiness companies who are establishing themselves in the Ukraine. Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, Monsanto, and others.
Really?
Yes. And so when we can't quite figure out why what's going on, I think what we need to do is look at the transnational corporations.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Bob, I'm going to have to do a little more research on that, but thanks for the tip, and appreciate it. Frank in Los Angeles, listening on KPFK. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Yes, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
There's a very lot of interesting voices on the air today, and I listen to you through KPFK.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to give you my, and I try to be brief, my point of view to your question, what would I do if the world or the human beings would be extinct in 2030?
Yeah.
What would I do different?
Mm-hmm.
I would make everything a priority. I have tried to do that for a long time, but under such a scenario, I would make it even more a priority. And by that I mean, in terms of choice of words, when it comes to the mainstream media, there is nothing that has to be removed from the airways. If we compare that with cancer, then we begin to understand, unless we have access to the airways, where they hear your voices, where they hear other rational voices, which they never hear on the mainstream media, we are doomed. And I would make that my priority, trying to get that word out. We have to break up these monsters.
The media monopolies.
Ways of doing this, and I think, unless we have access to that, where we have really access to information, these horrible things that goes on in Japan from the nuclear disaster, if the people would be aware what we can expect,
mm-hmm.
people would react totally differently. I think
you're right.
Time, but I think that's what we have to do. These are emergencies, and we have to treat it as such. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Frank. Well said. Very well said. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, I got a chance to watch the TED episode with Alan Savory.
I have watched it, and I've also read the debunking of it. It is,
oh, really?
Yeah, the assertion that he makes basically is that if we just returned all this fallow land to grassland, to pasture land with ruminant animals on it, that it would sequester enough carbon to stop global warming and save the world. That's an exaggeration. It would, though, be a significant thing. It would be, you know, he's on to something. He's just not on to the thing.
All right. Well, you know, it would be nice if, you know, we've got enough dry ice condensers. Why don't we operate them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and then instead of having, let's say, 100 dry ice condensers, let's put up 1,000 dry ice
because
condensers.
To pull a pound of carbon out of the atmosphere in the form of dry ice and sequester it, assuming that you can store that someplace where it's not going to eventually melt back out, takes several pounds of carbon being burned in an engine to produce the electricity to do that compression. That's a very, very inefficient, is an anti-efficient form of carbon sequestration. The forms of carbon sequestration that are promising are catalytic, are where you're taking common elements and in the presence of a catalyst, you're binding them to atmospheric carbon, particularly carbon dioxide.
Well, I mean, it's not
limestone
as efficient as the solar panels and solar collectors, and this most recent one is almost embarrassing that, you know, it has a whole desert in California covered with expensive $10,000 a piece mirrors. When you could actually get by utilizing mylar and scrap plywood and some old quarry stuff and cost a penny.
Well, that's a pretty high-tech facility. It can produce, you know, the electricity for hundreds of thousands of homes. My problem with it is that it's centralized. I think that if we were to put solar panels on every house in America, it would be, you know, problem solved. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, all the latest news and information you won't hear from the corporate-owned news media. Plus, has the left declared war on humans? I'll confront Discovery Institute's Wesley Smith, author of the new book, The War on Humans. And I'll be taking your calls. And remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag. You're it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.